Everyone, welcome to the court. We have two cases today, but before we begin, I would like to note that Judge Sparks cannot be here this morning. However, he will be participating fully on the record. Our first case, United States versus Ford. Because this is a TJAG certified case, Captain Murphy, you will go first. Are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Major Hopkins, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Appley?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Murphy, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Guarini, represent the United States. I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
We ask this court to vacate the ruling of the Army Court and affirm the findings and sentence because Appley affirmatively waived multiplicity. If this court instead finds mere forfeiture, the government respectfully asks this court to clarify that Forrester did not establish a separate test for multiplicity. If this court determines that Forrester is separate from Blockberger and created its own multiplicity test, or that Appley's convictions were based on the same criminal conduct, the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo 1 should be each violent offense.
Now, Captain Murphy, we had concurrent briefing in this case, so you did not have the opportunity to respond to the arguments that were posed in the defense brief. So I'd like you to take the opportunity to address their position that the accused in this case unequivocally waived, but in fact this court should look past this waiver because of the unsettled nature of the law.
Your Honor, we don't believe that the court should look past waiver and look to the unsettled area of the law. We don't agree that the law is actually unsettled in this area. We believe that the Army Court is conflating unreasonable multiplication of charges and multiplicity, that there are cases from the Army Court that can't be reconciled with each other, and that the Army Court is applying Article 128 case law to Article 128 Bravo without support, but the Army Court has been doing this in Appley and others in their favor. If this were a true unsettled area of law, certainly subsequent cases should and would get the benefit of that ruling, but that's not what we have here. The parties agree that there
So it's the government's position that if this is unsettled, that the accused would get the benefit of that?
If the court finds that this is truly unsettled, Your Honor, yes, Appley would get the benefit. But we don't believe it's unsettled, and we do believe that waiver applies here and that the parties agree that there was a deliberate decision not to raise multiplicity.
So, counsel, when you say that the Appley would get the benefit, you mean that we would pierce the waiver and treat it as a forfeiture and do plain error review? Is that what you mean when you say that Appley gets the benefit?
Your Honor, if this court finds that the area is unsettled, yes.
Okay.
So how would you square that with our decision in Cook, where we said that counsel are expected to raise, to object to an issue such as this, where the law is unsettled, if, in fact, certain interpretations could be favorable for the accused? Do you find that not applicable in this case?
Your Honor, candidly, I'm not familiar with Cook specifically. But here we believe that the issues from the Army Court would not have stopped Appley from raising the issue. And that instead Appley expressly waived multiplicity, and that the record establishes this express waiver, that Appley took affirmative action to intentionally relinquish this known right during the pretrial and the trial process. we can apply the presumption of competent counsel to whether Appley and his defense counsel knew at trial to seek dismissal of the domestic violence specifications on multiplicity grounds. So with the advice of competent counsel, Appley here specifically negotiated the changes to Specification 2 that he now argues make the specification multiplicious with Specification 4. So the government originally charged Appley with grabbing his wife's neck, and Appley ultimately pled guilty to grabbing his wife's arms. So in his unconditional plea of guilty, Appley made a deliberate decision to agree with the very result and consequence that his multiplicity claim now seeks to remedy. Further, also with the advice of competent counsel, Appley specifically made a deliberate decision to negotiate 12 to 18 months of confinement to run separately but concurrently for each violent act. The record also supports that this was an intentional relinquishment. When the military judge advised that all motions to dismiss should be made before the entry of pleas, defense counsel did not raise multiplicity. The military judge went on to discuss three times with Appley that even though there's no waiver of motions provision in his plea agreement, that Appley understood that he was waiving most motions. This exchange with the military judge highlighted that Appley knew and understood that he needed to raise any motions for appropriate relief before the military judge, that gave his defense counsel multiple opportunities to raise those motions, and it was repeated agreement that he did not intend to file any of those motions. Finally, during the Providence inquiry, after Appley said that there was a short time between the grabbing and the dragging and that they were two separate acts, defense counsel declined additional inquiry and did not move to consolidate specifications 2 and 4. Second, if this court finds mere forfeiture, the government respectfully asks this court to clarify that Forrester did not establish a separate test for multiplicity. The first step of the multiplicity inquiry in the guilty plea context focuses on whether the charges are facially duplicative. If the charges are not facially duplicative, they will never be multiplicious, whether under the same statute or different statutes. Two offenses are not facially duplicative if each requires proof of a fact that the other does not. Here, each specification as written contains different factual components and is not facially duplicative. The language for the actus reus in Specification 2 is distinct from that in Specification 4. In Specification 2, the government charged Appley with unlawfully grabbing his wife's arms with his hands, whereas in Specification 4, the government charged Appley with unlawfully dragging his wife in his hand. Further, looking at the Providence inquiry, Appley said for Specification 2, that act occurred when his wife first left the home and then fell, whereas Specification 4 occurred after a momentary separation when he dragged her. The government believes that the way that the Air Force Court framed the multiplicity analysis in United States v. Douglas, cited on page 16 of our brief, is the proper framework. So focusing on Coleman, Blockberger, Campbell, and Pauling, where the first step is to determine whether the charges involve separate acts, and the second step, if the charges involve a single act, then the court looks to congressional intent as to whether the statute allows for discrete act or continuous course of conduct charging. On the other hand, Forrester answered an unreasonable multiplication of charges question. In that case, the court appears to have borrowed the congressional intent test from the multiplicity framework, but did not create a separate test for multiplicity. So the government's position is that Forrester should be limited to unreasonable multiplication of charges in Article 134. However, if this court should determine that Forrester created a separate test for multiplicity, or that Appley's convictions stemmed from the same criminal conduct, the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo 1 should be each violent offense. To answer this question and determine whether Congress made an overt expression of legislative intent to whether charges should be viewed as multiplicious, we can turn to the plain language of the statute, which here suggests that Congress intended this new domestic violence statute to allow for discrete act charging. Article 128, Bravo 1, criminalizes any person who commits a violent offense. The use of A is a clear expression of legislative intent to punish separately and cumulatively for each and every violent offense, compared with Article 128, which merely prohibits bodily harm. Article 128, Bravo, is more like specialized assaults charged under Article 120 than Article 128, where under Article 120, each sexual act within a continuous course of conduct may be charged as a separate offense. The prior version of Article 128 already contained an aggravator for a family member, intimate partner, or spouse, and Congress felt that this was no longer sufficient. So by authorizing Article 128 Bravo as its own statutory provision in the FY19 NDAA, Congress clearly expressed its intent to view the offense of domestic violence as separate and apart from assault. However, even if this court considers the unit of prosecution to be the same as the underlying offense, here assault consummated by a battery, Appellee committed two separate acts. And we would ask the court to consider evidence of escalation as a factor as to whether multiple assaults were united in time, circumstance, and impulse in the domestic violence context. Here, Appellee committed two distinct escalating offenses. He grabbed his wife's arm after she tried to leave the house, and then she told him to get off of her, and he let go. His second act occurred when he dragged her across the neighbor's house towards his car. These acts were escalating because they increased in severity from grabbing her and letting go to dragging her and moving her against her will towards his vehicle. And he also told the military judge that he could have walked away. Pending any additional questions from this court, we ask the court to vacate the ruling of the Army Court and affirm the findings and sentence because Appellee affirmatively waived multiplicity in his unconditional plea of guilty.
May I ask a question? Are you suggesting that in the domestic violence situation charge, there could never be a concept of unit of prosecution other than just the act? So, for example, suppose he had dragged his wife across the front yard, let go, dragged her further across the driveway, let go, dragged her, grabbed her again, dragged her further across the sidewalk, that it would all be separate, that they could all be charged separately? I mean, it just seems that there's some common sense in the unit of prosecution under Article 128, and it would be hard to get away from that in the domestic violence context.
Your Honor, we would, for multiplicity purposes, we would argue that those are each distinct offenses. I think we would distinguish from, you know, for example, if an accused grabbed a victim maybe around their neck and then dragged them some distance, the grab and the drag in that case would likely be considered multiplicious because it's happening in one fell swoop. But where the accused lets go, that could indicate a separate impulse for each of those acts, those drags across the driveway. It could be because of some third-party intervention. It could be because, you know, like here, the victim asked Appellee to let her go. So we would argue those are separate impulses and are not multiplicious. And we know from looking at the legislative history for domestic violence, Your Honor, that Congress did want to deter abusive behavior for domestic violence specifically, because DV offenders are likely to be repeat abusers and the intensity of the violence is likely to grow over time. So we believe that domestic violence is not similar to assault and that Congress intended for each of those acts to be charged separately. It may ultimately be that would be viewed as unreasonable multiplication of charges, but we don't believe that they're multiplicious.
Counsel, I just want to clarify something you said earlier with regards to how the court should clarify Forster. I think you said that it should be limited to unreasonable multiplication of charges cases in Article 34 cases, or were those two separate ideas?
One idea, Your Honor.
Okay.
More like limiting Forrester to its facts and the unit of prosecution for child sex abuse material, Your Honor.
Okay.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Murphy. Major Hopkins.
Good morning. Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Andrew Hopkins, and along with my co-counsel, Major Bob Watkins, we represent PFC Ford in this case. This case presents a straightforward but unresolved question of the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo, domestic violence. Specifically, whether Congress authorized multiple punishments for each individual act within a single incident, or instead define these offenses in terms of a continuous course of conduct, as is reflected in the jurisprudence surrounding Article 128. That question has not been answered. The government doesn't know what the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo is. PFC Ford did not know what the unit of prosecution for 128 Bravo was at the time of his trial. The military judge did not know what the unit of prosecution was. The unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo is to this day unknown.
So, Major Hopkins, are you familiar with our case from last term, United States versus Cook?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the gist of it, of course, as you know then, is that counsel are still expected to object, even if the law is unsettled, if a certain interpretation of that area of the law could benefit the accused. So how do you address that case in this context?
I think what's important to distinguish, and specifically footnote 9 in the Cook opinion, which talks about this idea, is that in that case, it concerned the maximum punishments. In this case, it's the unit of prosecution. What we know about this case, without looking at the record, without looking at the agreement, without looking at anything particular to this case, is that the unit of prosecution is itself unknown. So this is not a case with respect to a maximum punishment on an assimilated U.S. Code provision. This is a new statutory provision under the Uniform Code of Military Justice that no one knows what the unit of prosecution is. And so we don't think that it should be treated on equal footing by a defense counsel or an appellant in this posture to necessarily raise the issue at trial.
So how does that fit with something you wrote in your brief? You said that trial defense counsel confronted the open question about multiplicity and then negotiated the plea agreement that accounted for that uncertainty. Why shouldn't that cause us to conclude that the defense counsel knew, yes, the law is unsettled, but I have a bargaining chip here because there is an interpretation of this that could benefit my client. I can use that with trial counsel to get a better deal. And why wouldn't that indicate that trial defense counsel did know in this, if we assume it is an unsettled area of the law, that this is something that trial defense counsel could use on the behalf of the accused?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. It was a potential bargaining chip there.
But why doesn't that cut against your argument in terms of nobody knew this area of the law. Not that it was just unsettled, but everyone was clueless about how this would play out in this particular scenario.
I think Your Honor's question highlights a very important distinction in this case, and that's the distinction between multiplicity, writ large, and the unit of prosecution. As this Court knows, there are often referred to as two species of multiplicity. That second species of multiplicity was often referred to as the single statute species of multiplicity. Another way to phrase it is simply determining what the unit of prosecution is. In this case, what is known post hoc is that no one knew what the unit of prosecution was. And so it's not a question of whether or not multiplicity itself was known and could have been waived. It's that the unit of prosecution, this Court knows they didn't know, because no one knows what the unit of prosecution for 128 Bravo is. And I think that that distinction is very important, and it's further highlighted by the fact that this case appears before this Court under the auspices of Article 67A2, under TJAG certification. I believe this is the fifth time that this question has been raised to the Court, highlighting the uncertainty surrounding this issue and the fact that it's been here before. It will be here again until the unit of prosecution is resolved. Accordingly, this Court should take this opportunity in this case, which is a good case and a good vehicle, to determine the unit of prosecution because it falls under one subsection. The facts are really undisputed here. This was a single impulse, all happening in the same episode. There's not a lot of factual noise to try to weave your way through to figure out. This is simply a matter of deciding once and for all whether Article 128 Bravo contemplates discrete act charging or whether it contemplates course of conduct charging. Having done that, we believe that this Court will find, as the statute, the terms of the statutes reflect, that this is a course of conduct offense. This Court can affirm the Army Court's decision as a correct, reflecting the correct understanding of what Congress authorized punishment for in this case.
Counsel, could you please address the government's argument that previously it was an aggravating factor under 128 that it involved family members? And then, of course, the law has been changed. We've got the new domestic violence statute. And I assume that under the previous version, we had the unit of prosecution being continuous course of conduct, not discrete acts. But then when they changed that and created domestic violence, the government says, well, the presumption must be that they didn't like the old way of doing it. And so now we've got a new way of doing it where it's not continuous course of conduct the way it used to be. What's your response to the government's argument?
Well, I think that's partly persuasive. I think it is apparent that the Congress intended to treat domestic violence differently, but it did so by creating 128 Bravo. PFC Ford stands convicted of domestic violence. He doesn't stand convicted of an assault consummated by battery. So just in the titling of his offense alone, society is now on notice as to what offense he has been convicted of. In addition, there are the sentence enhancements that come along with 128 Bravo, but there's nothing in any of that to suggest that all of a sudden Congress decided that each discrete act is now punishable under Article 128 Bravo. Your Honor gave the example of an episode where an offender, a domestic violence offender, is dragging someone repeatedly. Effectively, what happened in this case, consider a situation where, you know, a domestic violence incident where a parent is spanking a child 15 times at one, and without cause, it's a crime. But are we going to convict, did Congress intend to convict that abuser for each spanking? Common sense would suggest that they didn't, and certainly there's nothing in the terms of the statute itself that reflect that they intended that.
The government's response to that seems to be, well, that would be handled with unreasonable multiplication of charges. Not a multiplicity, but just under the RCM's unreasonable multiplication of charges.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that UMC obviously is a reasonableness analysis. But I'm suggesting this through the lens of statutory interpretation and considering what Congress intended and looking at the terms of the statute itself. And there's simply no reason to impute to them an intent to do something that would be unreasonable in application and violate common sense. But again, the court doesn't need to go that far. The court simply needs to look at the text of Article 128 Bravo itself. And from that, they will see that there is no clear indication that Congress intended this to be a discrete act offense. Given that, the rule of lenity and Supreme Court Bell suggests that the court should view this as a course of conduct offense.
Well, counsel, from a I was trying to turn to the actual language. From a textual perspective, you know, government argues that we are to look at the fact that it says a violent offense or a violent act, as opposed to any. And so what is your argument with regards to that?
Well, the violent offense here is an incorporation by reference to the underlying offending statutes. As applied in this case, it's Article 128. And I don't believe that the government is going to argue that Article 128 is a discrete act offense. It is a course of conduct offense. So I don't think that that argument is availing here. This case really, I think, is resolvable on the simple question as to what extent is 128 Bravo, as applied here, with an assault consummated by battery episode, whether it is incorporating that course of conduct, as this court recognizes Congress intended in Article 128. Your Honor, once the court determines the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo, this case resolves itself. The Army Court's decision correctly reflects the Congress's intended characterization of PFC Ford's offense. This court can simply affirm the Army Court's decision on that ground. Pending any questions from the court.
Counsel, can we please go back to the issue of waiver? And, you know, we get a lot of waiver questions here at the court, and I have a difficulty with the level of generality or how many steps back you're taking. Nobody knew the unit of prosecution, and so they couldn't have said, well, I'm waiving this knowing that the unit of prosecution is individual acts, because nobody knows whether that's true or not. But they did know, if you step back, that they were not making an objection to the specifications. I mean, it's similar to other cases that we hear where maybe you didn't know about a particular instruction, but you knew you were waiving your objection to all the instructions or any other aspect of waiver. How do we resolve that issue of what you have to, when we say for affirmative waiver that it has to be knowing and intelligent, where do you cut it off? Is it, well, I know I'm not objecting to the specifications, or I know I'm not objecting to the fact that this particular specification is defective because it focuses on single act as opposed to course of conduct?
Your Honor, I think if you look at this court's jurisprudence surrounding the waiver and forfeiture distinction, it oftentimes, at least by my lights, turns on the intentional relinquishment, I'll call it a prong. Is what they did, is what they said, do the exchanges between the military judge and the counsel or the accused, do the terms of the plea agreement, do these all reflect an intentional relinquishment, a voluntary abandonment, versus simply a failure to bring something up? This case really highlights this other issue, which goes to the known right and the contours of that known right. And again, I think it's important to think about multiplicity, not only in distinction from unreasonable multiplication of charges, but as kind of bifurcated within itself, this single statute versus blockburger situation. In this case, single statute, multiplicity case, the unit of prosecution is unknown. It's unknown. And there's no question that it's unknown. And so we think that has some meaning and importance in this case, in the way that the court views this case. Now, it could be that this case decides to resolve the question on waiver as it did in Malone. We won't say that the court doesn't have that discretion. We would suggest to the court that because this case arrives here under TJAC certification, it also has the discretion to reach the unit of prosecution question. Indeed, the first certified question for this court is really framed in terms of a Malone-specific exchange. Does no motions count as a waiver? Well, no motions. That exchange doesn't even appear in this case. And this Court's already answered that question in Malone. So in some sense, that question is moot. The unit of prosecution question is very much alive and very much before this Court under 67A2. So we encourage this Court to resolve that question. We think that the terms of the statute are dispositive on the matter, that it is a course of conduct offense. And we also suggest that once the Court, in its discretion, reaches that certified question, resolves the unit of prosecution, they can affirm the Army Court as correctly characterizing PFC Ford's crimes in this case.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Hopkins. Mr. Murphy?
Your Honor, the parties agree that there was a deliberate decision not to raise multiplicity. With the advice of competent counsel, Appley specifically negotiated the changes to his plea agreement, and he repeatedly affirmed to the military judge that he did not intend to file any motions. Appley could have objected, but he wanted to preserve his deal and retain the benefit of his bargain. Extending the transaction doctrine from Article 128 to Article 128 Bravo effectively sends the message to domestic abusers that once they land the first blow, those that follow soon thereafter are immune from criminal responsibility. Here, Appley committed two distinct escalating offenses. Because the charges here involve separate acts and are not facially duplicative, they are not multiplicious. Even if this Court turns to the plain language of the statute to determine congressional intent, the plain language of a violent offense suggests that Congress intended this new domestic violence statute to allow for discrete act charging, unlike Article 128. Pending any additional questions from this Court, we ask the Court to vacate the ruling of the Army Court and affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand in recess until 10:15.
The Court stands in recess until 10:15.